Hello, and welcome to Arcane Connection, episode 14. And joining me today is Thomas Knoll.
Hello.
Hi, Tom. How are you doing?
Not too bad, Chris.
It's been a very long time since we last recorded an episode, hasn't it?
It's been a while, but we're keen to give the Ars Magica fans what they really want.
Yeah, but we can't do that, so instead, we're going to talk for a whole 30 minutes.
Yes.
So, it's been quite a while, and the reason for that, it's been complex. People have been ill. Tom got a job. So,
yes.
In fact, I think on the last podcast, I congratulated you, didn't I?
I think so, yes.
So, well done on having a job. There's been a few attempts to record since then. We've got the fantastic new microphone. Now, it's obviously the first thing we've got to do is start by thanking everybody who was involved in giving us this microphone,
yep.
Which I hope has really made a massive difference. And in particular, I'd like to thank my co-author and collaborator on many projects in the past, Timothy Ferguson, who organised the Secret Masters of Fandom, but everybody who donated, and I hope it wasn't just Timothy, I really do. So we've got some better sound recording equipment, and hopefully you can hear us all the better.
I hope so too.
We're unable to play back at the moment because I've destroyed my speakers, but don't worry, don't send any. I'm getting some new speakers. At the moment, they sound like voices calling out in a vast echoey cavern, as our sound
yes. Picture. It sounds like electronic voice phenomena.
Yeah, but you're not here to hear about parapsychology. You're not here to hear about Tom's new job. You're not even here to hear about my exciting ideas on fashion or whatever else I'm going to talk about. No, you're here to talk about Ars Magica. And recently, there's been a lot of discussion on the forum about things like, do we need Mythic Europe? What direction should a new edition of Ars Magica take?
And alternate settings.
Alternate settings. And Andrew Kronowski started a couple of those threads. I started the heretical one where I said, well, why don't we ditch Mythic Europe? Which proved to be, shall we say, an unpopular choice.
Most people who are popular on the forums, they like Mythic Europe. It's what's attracted them in. Without Mythic Europe, the game loses a lot of appeal.
Sure, sure. Now, I mean, when I first joined the Barklist, it's famous that the first week I was involved, there was a long discussion about the protein yield of turnips on the North European plain, in particular in the area of Pomerania, in the early 13th century. And that was my first impression of Ars Magica fans, was that they were absolutely terrible historians of biology,
yes,
who spent their time being obsessed by the protein yields of medieval turnip.
Yes.
And in fact, this has come up time and time again in things I've written over the years.
It has.
But
even more than nailed chamber pots.
Yeah, even more than that. That wasn't me, though. That was Michael. But yeah, the point is that these in-jokes do appear. Doesn't really matter about that for the moment. The point was that the stodgy historical stuff was really off-putting to a lot of people, I think. And it's amazing that I actually stuck with the game after that first week. And I mean, the Barklist is great. We had a lot of good times over there. It was like the forum. The advantage of a forum as opposed to an email list is you can read it if you want to, and if it doesn't interest you, you can skip.
It's easy to skip to whichever thread you like and ignore the threads you don't.
Yeah, and the old idea of the paradigm police, again, is part of previous editions now. It's pretty much forgotten. Nobody's going to accuse you of playing the game the wrong way.
No.
You could play Ars Magica however you want to play Ars Magica. That's got to be a good thing, hasn't it?
Definitely.
But there was, in the past, a genuinely historically minded fan base. Yeah?
That's fair to say.
And their particular interpretations of history were dominant, and I think it was off-putting to a lot of people. I don't think it bothered me greatly, because I'm a historian by training, but, it did bother a lot of people.
I don't know, because when I started playing Ars in the mid-90s, we just went with whatever the GM was running, trusted the GM style of play,
sure.
Didn't know much about the game, so we followed with what our GM did and the scenarios they liked.
Well,
they picked and chose from history the bits they liked.
The problem you've got, partly, is that the one thing I've never been really able to abide in RPG culture is seriously pretentious people. Now, I'm pretty hardcore. I mean, I'm fairly hardcore when it comes to Ars Magica. And, okay, you think I'm pretentious.
Yes, Chris.
I don't understand why you think I'm pretentious. When I was having lunch with the Queen the other day,
yes.
I said, I hate name droppers, as you
yes.
always say about me. Yeah.
Yes.
But no, jokes aside, I mean, you have this strange idea that I'm not just hardcore, but pretentious in my role-playing. I used to find World of Darkness players really off-putting. Because I found them incredibly pretentious. Am I the only person in the world who feels
to be fair, you know, back in the 90s, there were lots of people that poking fun at the people who enjoyed playing Vampire to see how angsty their characters could get. And if your characters couldn't get themselves into one truly doomed, hopeless situation each week, there was no point playing.
They were good games, and I knew. I mean, I did actually play some World of Darkness games and really enjoyed them. But that element of pretension combined with a... But this is a game which, you know, the players need to know Latin to play and nonsense like that. Because, I mean, obviously you don't, so I would never have got to play it. We all know the truth about Ars Magica. But I think there is an element of the Ars Magica fan base which like to wind people up.
True. But people do have very firm opinions about history. People do have their very own takes, depending on which history books they've read, which sources. Because, after all... as my good friend Paul, who wrote a PhD on how Hollywood affects people's opinions of history, everyone's seen different movies, everyone's read different works, and a lot of these fictional works take on a strong and vivid life in your imagination as to how the medieval world should look, which is completely at odds with what you'll see anytime you open an actual serious history book.
Yeah, so people have an idea of history. And actually, that dramatic history is the one we want to aim for, it's the one we want to share. Because although real history is sometimes more interesting, and actually, if the players can't relate to it, they're never going to enjoy Mythic Europe.
Yeah.
But Mythic Europe's a vast place, and it's mythic.
Yes.
It's not real history. The word mythic gives it away. And I hate the term Mythic Europe. Every time I have to type it, I want to scream. Because I don't want to type, you know, in 785, Bonisagus stood upon the Alps top of a mountain and gazed out across Mythic Europe. I want to say... Bonasagas stood upon the peak of the Matterhorn and gazed across Europe. You know, the word mythic. But it's constantly kept there as a reminder that this is not real history. This is a game.
Yeah.
And you can do what you want, what works for your story. Now, that's where we're really getting interesting. Now, going back to the future of the game, because that's what everyone's talking about, and they're assuming that we need a new edition before we can explore other settings. I think we're coming towards the end of the books you can do. We've done most of the tribunals, we've done the houses, we've done the realms, we've done the cities, we've done apprentices. I mean, you know, how many more books are there that can be done?
I don't know, because the size bookshelf is massive already.
Yeah, we can continually invent new Ars Magica books for 5th, I'm sure. But the obvious thing to do would be to do the tribunals again 50 years later. How do you think that would work? Or 100 years later?
I think definitely you want to go as far in the future as possible if you're trying that.
Yeah. You want to go post-Black Death?
Maybe. At least 100 years. At least not before mid-1320s, 1330s.
So actually during the Black Death. So there's a...
Shortly before, or maybe shortly after.
Because the Black Death changes everything.
Yes.
And of course, intellectually, it's a period of ferment leading up to the Black Death. I mean, the High Middle Ages is where the game's traditionally been set. And in a sense, I think it would be a shame to move it into the Renaissance or into the 1340s. In a sense, I do actually like the 1200s. I did actually like 1197 as a setting. Now, Timothy, I think, was the person who suggested going back to the 1060s or 1050s.
Yes.
There's a lot going on back then. Norman invasion of Sicily, I think. Norman invasion of England.
Yes, because all the Viking and Norman movements around Europe haven't settled down yet.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good period for a game. You've also got the run-up to the Schism War.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's a lot of potential there. Exploring the setting in another time, Mythic Europe in another time, is a great idea, perhaps. My question is whether or not there is actually a... argument for getting rid of Mythic Europe. Now look, this is my plan, this is what I'd like to see. Firstly, I think we need to, the thing that's impeding Ars Magica at the moment, is we can stay in Mythic Europe, but we're going to have to make some sacrifices.
Such as?
The magic system.
Okay.
Well, in fact, magic.
So, if we take the magic out of Ars Magica, have Ars A?
Agricola. Ars Agricola.
The art of the farmer.
The art of the farmer. Now, what we actually need to do is to sacrifice this stuff about the magic, lab, twilight, all of the magic system, basically.
Okay.
Because I think you agree that there are lots of other games that offer magic systems.
That's very true.
Whereas the strength of Ars Magica, being Mythic Europe, is that, you know, that's different. It's distinct. So, magic is overly common. There are very few games which allow you to accurately discuss the protein yield of a Pomeranian turnip. Can you think of any other game which allows you to actually deal with vegetables in that level?
I disagree. After all, your good friend Andy and his Quiet 2000 game, where how to get those tractors working so you could rebuild those potato fields, get Eastern Europe back onto a sustainable agricultural basis in a nuclear winter.
I didn't play in that game, but I can see that would be, But the other game...
But I see where you're going. I see there's a potential market for this, yes.
And also, farming is big. The board game Agricola has sold a million copies. I don't know. It sold a vast number. It's a massive seller. It's got an iPhone app. It's a game of farming in maybe the 16th century. Agricola has shown that there is a role for farming-based products.
Farmville. There's no bigger web app.
Absolutely. Farmville was massive for years on the internet, on Facebook. Farmville showed that people want to plant crops. Yeah.
Yes.
So, I think what we've actually uncovered here is the direction that Atlas should move in, which is to get rid of the magic system entirely and move towards Ars Agricola.
Okay.
Yeah.
But so, are we keeping, say, any of the supernatural elements at all, though? Such as, I don't know, leaving a bowl of milk out for the fairies?
You see, that's a difficult one, because
this is
an
important part
issue.
Of the paradigm you need to keep in mind here.
Yeah, I mean, the problem is, if we're getting rid of magic, I think leaving out milk for the fairies, it is part, but I think what it should do is that the rules should seriously reflect reality, and we should go for the simulationist element, because I think narrativist indie games, while popular, don't necessarily reflect the core market for Ars Magica, which is simulationist, second-generation gamers. So I would say that we have the rules work, and that indeed you're penalised psychologically for not putting out milk for the fairies, but it should have no effect on the protein yields.
No effect on the protein yields of your turnips.
No.
Okay.
Now, I mean, years ago, actually, I did try and work out how often dragons appear in the Chronicles over Britain, and I went through a number of the medieval Chronicles, and I worked out that once a decade there would be a dragon rampage in England. And that, in fact, in a 100-year period, you know, it was actually slightly more. I think it was once every 8 years or something like that, but at least once a decade.
So the point is every county would get hit at least once a century by a dragon.
Well, yeah, about once every century and a half a county would definitely get a dragon rampage.
Yes.
And I tried to work out how many mythic cows, which are like mythic pennies, because of course cows come in different shapes and sizes, it would take to feed one dragon. And then, but this was partly based on my simulationist love of chivalry and sorcery, where you start off with things like, you know, what the fertility of the land is, work out what the population and agricultural base is. By using mythic Europe, we don't actually need to go there.
No.
And, I mean, I did actually do that in Chivalry and Sorcery many years ago. I built a campaign based upon starting with the fertility of the land and working out the soils and the alluvial deposits and working out from that what the population was sustainable.
Exciting?
And nobody ever played it because the
players... Was it even more exciting than sitting in a cold garage pretending to be on a bomber mission over World War II Germany?
Probably not, but that was Chris Southgate, not me, but that was the absolute pits. But yeah, Bomber Command was the worst game I ever played. Real-time bomber missions.
You spent several hours sat there in the cold waiting to see if you actually make it over the North Sea first before you decide to time the drop.
I think we've gone far enough with the Ars Agricola concept for now. I think the fan base is just going to run with this and realise that it is the future of Ars Magica as was, and that what we need is a hardcore game of farming in medieval Europe because that has a greater commercial appeal.
Okay.
But let's assume for the moment that there might actually be a few heretics out there who disagree with my vision. Yeah.
Ah, in which case you mean the opposite, go completely away from simulationist towards narrativist, call it fairy stories, and have it being as narrative about wandering through the magical fairy realms at will as angels and demons stop you.
Yeah, no, you see, again, we're losing Ars Magica there, aren't we? Because it's no longer Ars Magica. At least Ars Agricola would have hardcore game mechanics based loosely upon the magic system for working out how well your turnips are cultivated. But I think there are indie elements that can be brought into the game, because, I mean, amongst the Forge community, and which was a subset of the indie gaming community some years ago, I don't think it exists anymore, amongst the indie gaming community, there was always a lot of respect from Edwards and others like that, who were indie pioneers, if you like, game theorists, for Ars Magica. And I know games theory is often, you know, something people aren't happy to talk about or just get annoyed by, but I think there was a lot of useful stuff probably came out of it. Had I read any, I would probably know more. Obviously, I've read some. What I think was very important, though, is that Ars Magica was seen as a pioneering all kinds of new ideas. I mean, for one thing, pretty much every RPG ever created, you played a single character.
Yes.
I'm trying to think of another game that gave you perspective on the setting from two or three different characters. Are there any?
I'm trying to think now. See, Ars invented the idea of troop play. I mean, there is little bits of it in some other games where you might try and design sidekicks. Or say the newest Warhammer 40k one, where people have their fellow unit members running alongside them in a military unit. But that's not the same as having characters of different, very different social levels, social statuses, and outlooks on life, and you taking turns between them.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things we can say about that was it was unique. And to this day, I mean, it often gets lost. People still very often just play their Magi, given the chance.
Yeah.
I actually enjoy it more when I enforce it and we actually play a mix of characters, don't you?
It does make a big difference in the game.
Yeah, I think it makes for a better game.
Also, the more Magi you have, the more different magical specialties you have, the easier it is just to go, I'll fix it by casting a spell.
Yeah, and I mean, we've run quite a successful campaign as well using troop play. Me and Tom have run most of the adventures. Anybody else run one? I can't remember.
Did Lloyd run a session? And Phil's managed to run the treacle mine one.
Right, Phil ran a session. I think even Kev ran one at one point. I don't know if that was in this campaign or a previous one. But Kev has run sessions. Luke doesn't turn up often enough to run anything.
Yep.
But I mean, you know, it works well. Troop play, again, with everybody, as long as you've got a common vision.
Yes.
It tends to be one person's storylines dominate at a given time. I mean, Tom did most of the York stuff, though I did a bit of that.
Yep.
But me and Tom both like exploring the legends of our childhood.
Yes.
Another reason we like Mythic Europe, we both grew up in places. Tom grew up in York, I grew up in most of my life in Bury St Edmunds, or thereabouts, between Bury St Edmunds and Thetford. And I mean, these are places with strong medieval cultures, loads of folk tales, legends, and stuff we know, which we like to explore in the game.
Yeah. I mean, you like the stories of, you know, abbeys and medieval landowners and various wars going through your part of the country, whereas I like stories of, you know, saints and medieval lords and urban medieval Europe and dragons, because the northeast of England is teeming with dragons.
Oh, we had dragons down in Sudbury, black and white dragons who fought at Sharp Fight Meadow, which are recorded. I wrote years ago on the Bark List a little thing called Here Be Dragons. In fact, I should dig those out because they should be published on the forum now. Because they were a load of things I wrote for the Bark List that were, you know, compilations of facts about historical folk tales and legends from Britain. I enjoyed writing those. I think that was actually one of the ways I came into writing for Ars Magica. So, okay, we're about halfway into the podcast and we haven't really got to any kind of meat apart from discussing that we like medieval Europe, we like mythic Europe, we think it could be off-putting. I asked on the forum, most people said we should stick with it.
Yep.
And I think that that is the basis for the fan base we have at the moment. I think if there's a new addition, you know, there's an argument for not sticking with it, or for at least offering variant settings.
Yeah.
But the question is whether it's just not sticking with 1220 rather than sacrificing Mythic Europe entirely. I don't know.
Yeah.
What mechanical elements would you change? Because I mean, you know, I've talked to other people who've been working on ideas for what should be the future of Ars Magica, especially Andrew Granowski, and I'm not going to talk about his ideas because they are absolutely excellent. Some of them we've come up with some ideas together on different things we'd like to see, which might make it into a Sub Rosa article or somewhere in the future, but at the moment, you know, I don't want to talk about his innovations.
Okay.
The stuff I'm interested in is I wondered if ours would be better if we made a few tweaks in the direction of indie gaming.
Such as?
Well, the first thing that I actually wanted to talk about this podcast, it's quite radical, it's not quite as radical as Ars Agricola, it does involve magic, was that, you know, at the moment we've just come to a natural end in our storyline. We can't discuss what we're doing because we've been playtesting.
Okay.
But we've come to an end of what we were doing with something, a project.
Yes.
And we're going to go back to Ars Magica. And I was thinking about maybe even running 4th edition just because it's so simple and I haven't played it for a long time. I do like Ars 4th edition.
Okay.
But everybody's got the 5th edition books and everyone likes 5th edition. So we'll go with 5th edition. But what I was thinking about doing was hacking the rules. And I've started to write a document which is called Brief Lives of the Magi, which starts off as an introduction to Ars Magica, looking at the gift, looking at magic from the perspective of an apprentice. And then when you get to character generation, it all changes, because the first thing that I've tried to do with Brief Lives of the Magi is stick with the Ars Magica 5 rules, but this is just a document for the campaign. But story flaws, when you take story flaws, they're not part of your 10 plus and minus. In fact, you probably won't get 10 plus and minus.
Right.
You'll get a certain number of virtues that will be used to balance magic So you can't, for example, balance increased capacity like magical focus fire by odious social habits, pick nose.
Okay.
They'll be completely separate, distinct things.
Right.
So your magical focuses will be your hermetic virtues and flaws.
Yeah.
And a few bits, other general flaws, will be balanced in some ways.
Okay.
But you'll then have personality traits. Now, the personality traits, I want to have a bigger role in the game, so I'm rewriting the rules on how they work.
Okay.
To make them more important.
Because the point of ours, it's a very straightforward. Put three things down about your character.
+1, +2, +3. Change them as the character changes.
Yeah.
Now, I do like the
idea of being able to change. As opposed to, say, Pendragon, where you go, here's your list of the 21.
Yeah, I'm not going for anything as structured as the Pendragon system. I thought what we'd do is we'd start off by writing three visual things about your character. What are the first three things somebody notices about your character? Old and stooped. A roving eye. Wears green robes and has a monkey on his shoulder. Yeah. You know, whatever. I mean, you choose three visual cues for your character. Then you choose three personal or social traits for your character.
Okay.
Which are overpowering desire to thwart bullies, for example, which is a personality trait.
Fair enough.
It could be a fragment of a sentence, or overbearingly egotistical in female company. You know, quite specific.
Okay.
But my planning for this game we're going to run is that you'll only gain confidence when you fulfill personality traits.
Okay.
And you can even lose confidence points when you oppose your personality trait. So confidence will be related to your...
So instead of relating to what you do and how well you succeed or fail, it'll instead be about how you are in character.
Yeah, and you'll get... Confidence points will still be spent to give you a bonus on a roll.
Yeah.
But you'll have to show how the personality trait is relevant to the roll.
Okay.
Or how... Another thing I'm thinking about doing is, you're not going to like this, losing the stats.
How do you mean, losing the stats?
Getting rid of strength, dex, stamina, power... presence, charisma.
Well, yeah. The thing of all of those are nice and straightforward. Stat plus your skill level combined together. People are used to that from storyteller-style games,
absolutely.
A lot of role-playing games.
Absolutely.
Very nice and straightforward way of how you work things out.
For what I'm doing at the moment, I was thinking about making them virtues and flaws. So you start with zero in everything. If you've got an excessive strength, you take a virtue or a flaw.
Okay.
So, you know, you choose those in virtues and flaws rather than taking additional characteristic points.
Right.
So that could work. I don't know if it matters really or not. I want to go more into the stat descriptions, which is something Ars Magica created. So when you've got strength...
I think I'd make a lot of characters blander, because instead of their gentle ups and downs of their characteristics, you're going to have most characters being very plain, very ordinary in most things, except for the one or two things they're exceptional in.
One of the things that troubles me is there are some dump stats, because Magi are gifted, they quite often take negative presence, because they're never going to be able to, even with charm, which is a very useful, overly generic skill. But one of the things I liked about the old system... Oh, it's a lorry reversing outside.
Yes.
We're not being exterminated by dialects for these heretical ideas. That is actually just something outside. Tom's going to shut the window. Yeah, I think there's a real case for doing something about the stats. But anyway, that doesn't matter. That's completely irrelevant to what I was going to say. So, firstly, we've talked about personality. So, personality traits will be subsumed into writing the description on your character sheet of how you look, how you interact with others.
Okay.
So you've got three personalities, three social interaction traits, and three appearance traits that you write, which give you a simple +1 bonus or +2 bonus, perhaps, if they're ever relevant to another skill stat combination.
Okay.
So, for example, you could take immensely muscular, rippled muscles as a descriptive thing, which would give you +3 strength. That was one of the things I was thinking of. But we didn't go that drastically at the moment. I'm playing with ideas. This is for the new campaign, which I'm planning to start in a couple of weeks. Another thing I want to do, though, and this is where it gets a bit more drastic, is... You're going to start off as a group by designing your covenant. Covenant's going to come first.
Okay.
Yeah? And the covenant, I'm going to ask you to come up with a storyline, what the covenant is about.
You do realise that everyone's going to have very, very different and opposing ideas.
I do. And I'm going to ask you to come up with one major story arc.
Okay.
And then to discuss sub arcs, you know, other ideas and stories that can be incorporated into that. And then the virtues and flaws, or the boons and hooks rather, will be directly reflected when we map out the saga.
Okay.
So everyone will know when they're running a story, what the story will be about.
Okay.
And the general... Now, that will change, because if, for example, the Covenant burns down at the end of a story,
yep,
we're going to have to remap the arc. But generally, we're all going to know that it's a story about a group of magi living in Northumbria, living in, we'll say, Cumberland, who have angered the local fairy lord, who has an evil custom and demands a terrible price.
Okay.
And at the end of the saga, it is whether or not that you can survive his persecutions and lie low long enough to build up the strength to eventually defeat the evil Lord Curtain.
Okay.
Or whatever. You know, you'll know where the arc is going. I mean, that's actually a really rubbish idea. Come up with one, Tom. You're good at this kind of thing.
I'm just trying to think, because you know what? You want it in a story arc. Rather than the traditional, say, we set it in a secluded place in Novgorod.
Yeah, no, no.
So instead of talking about the setting and talking about local people we might interact with,
yeah,
and what the local politics
will be,
it's about
what the big story is.
What the big story will be about.
For example, this is going to be a novel about a hobbit who finds a magic ring and has to drop it down a volcano against the forces of evil. You know,
so this is a story of how a magus and his several companions perform secret missions for the Quisitors to restore balance to Mythic Europe while not getting caught, and if they are disavowed, they will be destroyed by Arcane Connection.
Yeah, or this is a sort of James Bond-style genre one. Yeah, it would be like that. Or this is the story of how one mage has schemed his way to become Primus of House Bonasagas by a series of magical breakthroughs that revolutionised magic and changed Mythic Europe forever, which might go well with Hermetic projects. Now, but there in terms of magi, okay, I'm talking in terms of covenants. This is the story of a covenant that survived a terrible evil and a blight upon the land during the civil wars of the baronial conflicts 1215 to 1218 England. You know roughly how long it's going to last when you start.
Okay.
And then you map out how many stories you're going to use to get there. And I'm thinking that for a major story flaw, a character should have three stories at least that focus entirely upon that story flaw.
Okay.
So if you've taken enemies and the enemies are a baron, that baron's going to turn up. So I like that idea. I thought it worked. But there's also, I'm going to go on a bit longer than famous, because if you've taken enemies, I'm going to give you experience points in completing a story flaw.
Okay.
So story flaws aren't going to be part of your plus 10, minus 10. You're going to have one major, one minor story arc for your character.
Okay.
You'll define the story arc, and I will assign a number of sessions from 3 to 9, depending on how long the saga is, which is the number of XP you need to resolve that storyline.
Okay.
And whenever in the game you actually get... Well, they're not XP, they're story completion points, call them what you will. But as you defeat the character and the plot develops, you'll get so many points towards completing that arc.
Right.
So if your character, if Darkwing's ambition is to defeat the Baron of Nantwich and seize a castle in Cheshire and be restored to his family lands and marry his childhood sweetheart, that story will accumulate throughout, and the referee will know that that's
so
what the story is.
Crucial points of romancing the childhood sweetheart. Crucial points of when they attack a castle,
retake the castle,
holding
on to the castle and finding the king's agreement, finding justice, etc. Those key points, everyone will know from the beginning that they will feature in the story.
Right.
They may change, but they are the key points you will need to fulfill to complete the arc. So there's almost a win condition, but everybody knows at the beginning what the story's about and has a strong sense of, and has agreed, we're going to tell a story about this.
Okay.
Now, that sounds really dull, because it sounds like there won't be surprises. Of course there'll be surprises.
It sounds about as exciting as that scenario where we all retell the Dracula myth.
Yeah, we don't need to retell Dracula exactly. I actually thought that was quite interesting. What you do is you know what it's going to be about, but you've got no idea at all how the referee is going to frame... So you know who your enemy is, but suddenly, you know, you might be in a feast in a totally unassociated story, and your enemy might be invoked, and a group of knights might turn up, or you might be planning to use a simple Mentem spell to defeat him, but you'd never know that he's become friends with a powerful wizard and has got a ring now that prevents mind-altering spells from working on him. So, you know, your plan falls through. Or you might not realise that one of the servants in your castle is actually the Baron who has come to make amends and has planned to restore your castle to you and make all right if you treat your servants well, for he is a wise and just man. Or, you know, whatever the storyline is, there's still a vast mystery. You're not just playing out by rote the actions, but you know what the saga is going to be about from the beginning. So I think we're going to try that and just see if it works. What do you think? Does it sound interesting?
Has possibilities. I see what you mean about having the different story conditions build up as you go along. A friend of mine once had a game where, because in order to have people not go up to, like, here I am, a huge epic level, and no, I don't want to have my character retire and be replaced by a lower level one, what he would deliberately do is have, you have a set number of story points you have to achieve.
Yep.
When you get one of those story points, your character will get rewarded with something in-game to boost your character's power. And then once you've completed all the story things for your character will hang around for a few sessions more before they retire off into the sunset, having achieved their life's big goal.
Yeah, that was roughly what... I mean, you know, the idea is that the saga's not just going to be a bunch of magi doing stuff in sandbox play. There is going to be a big storyline. Now, because I love sandbox play, and I love you going into Bury St. Edmunds and I using my knowledge to invent things on the fly, and I'm sure you do it exactly the same way, suddenly you'll go to a certain bridge and I'll remember a piece of folklore associated with it, so I'll bring it into the game, and the players will come up with plans and head off to talk to the Primus of House Tremere. You know, whatever happens, Tremere, every time we play, it's going to be completely different and the arc is going to disappear. But the broad notion of a story that is about something and bringing it focused back and taking story flaws from just being a dump way to get rid of, to balance some cool magic powers,
right,
and actually making them the focus of what the character's about, making the story about stuff, just appeals to me at the moment. So I want to try running it just the once and see how it goes. And if we don't enjoy it by Christmas, it's fine, because by that time I'll have finished my research and I'll be ready to go with the new iteration, Ars Agricola.
And those turnip yields, everyone will be playing a Herban Mage.
Exactly. I mean, Swedish turnips, the Swede, have revolutionised cattle feed in the 17th century in Britain. I think they're brought in around about the 1670s, 1680s. I could be wrong. Now, Coke Norfolk was using them in, what, 1730s, 1740s? He revolutionises agriculture up there. But I mean, at the end of the time, I mean, this is going to be, we're going to be, you know, going Jethro Tull here. And yes, I don't mean standing on one leg playing a flute. I mean, draining the fens, seed drilling, high intensity farming, looking at yields. Ars Agricola has to be the way forward, yeah?
It's a way forward, which will get an entirely different audience to what you'd expect, Chris.
Yeah. Fanatical, firm ones who won't come around my house with pitchforks and torches.
That's right.
Right. Well, thank you, everybody. It's been a... What are we going to call this one? The one where they talked about turnips? Yeah, the one where they talked about turnips.
Yes.
It's been a very different episode. We've talked about ideas for Ars Magica.
Yep.
And thank you for still listening, and I hope you found it entertaining, and I hope you appreciate the hard work that some of us have put into thinking about the future of where we think the game should be going.
And I'm going to fetch Chris's volume soon.
Yeah. It's been great talking to you, Tom. Thank you very much.
And thank you, Chris.
Good night.